Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Say I'm a sound scientist, came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hi, I'm Todd.
I'm Amanda.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Humanism is reason and compassion in action. At least that's my favorite definition.
That's a good definition. I like that. Welcome to the show, Amanda Metzkes. Amanda, listeners, is a hero of mine within the movement. She's Miss Camp Quest, I guess. I don't know if you prefer Ms. or Mrs. Camp Quest, but...
Probably Ms. I don't think Camp Quest is married.
Yeah, but you seem to be married to Camp Quest. Is that fair?
Sometimes it does seem like that, yes.
So Amanda has been affiliated with Camp Quest for a decade now. I don't know if it seems that long, but she was on the board of directors for a number of years and has been the executive director since 2008. She's also an author. She was actually the co-author, along with several others, including Dale McGowan, of Raising Free Thinkers, a practical guide for parenting beyond belief. And she's here today because she's awesome and a lot of fun, and I thought she'd be great to have on as a co-host. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Todd.
So how are things in the world of Camp Quest? You probably should tell our listeners a little bit about what Camp Quest is.
Sure. Camp Quest is a network of summer camps aimed at children from non-religious families. So children of atheists, agnostics, humanists, free thinkers. And what our camp is really about is fun, friends, and free thought. So all the typical fun summer camp stuff, you know, canoeing, swimming, hiking, arts and crafts, all that good stuff. Plus building a community. That's the friends part, you know, where you come back to camp year after year because of those, you know, late night chats you have in your cabin with your fellow campers and those friendships that you form. And then the free thought part is all of the educational activities we do at camp. So we do science experiments. We do critical thinking challenges. We do philosophy. We do a little bit of world religions. We do some ethical dilemmas, those sorts of things. The main take home point is that camp's a lot of fun, and it's a place where kids who maybe don't have a community of other kids back home who share their family's worldview can come and feel safe and feel comfortable being themselves.
That's fantastic. I can say from experience, it's a lot of fun. I was a counselor last year, went with my son, and this year we're going to come back and I'll be a counselor again in Ohio. I'm bringing both of my kids this year, and I'm really excited and looking forward to it. As a matter of fact, we were talking earlier about the concept of adding human catapults to Camp Quest, and I was wondering if you accepted that suggestion or not.
Well, I have to talk to my insurance agent. We have a meeting tomorrow. I think it's not likely to fly, but pun intended. But I'll talk to the insurance agent tomorrow, and I'll get back to you.
With catapults, things are sure to fly. Perhaps not with insurance, but yeah, it's a blast. The funny thing is catapults are the type of thing that would be built, not to throw humans, but perhaps eggs or something like that. Some of the science and the projects are some of the best parts about it, actually.
Yeah, I believe they're building catapults, not human-sized catapults, at Camp Quest, Oklahoma this year.
Just ones large enough to, like, throw rocks at opposing camps, or?
I think we'll try to be a little less violent, you know, use them mainly for maybe some competitions to see whose catapults fire the furthest, that sort of thing.
Don't worry, parents. You can trust me with your children. So tell me what's new at Camp Quest. So what's going on? Anything new and exciting going on?
Definitely some new and exciting things. We hired our second ever full-time staff person. So we now have, in addition to me working in the office, we have Mary Barzak, who is our program manager. And one of the super cool things about Mary, in addition to the fact that she's an artist and she's brilliant and talented, is that she started out as a camper at the very first year of Camp Quest ever, back in 1996. So she's been involved with Camp Quest for even much longer than I have. So it's awesome to have her on the team. And then we also just approved a new Camp Quest camp location in Colorado. So they are working on getting started. and we're going to have record registration this summer. We have 16 sessions in North America. 5 of them are already full.
I've heard that actually. Some people wanted to get their kids in and like, oh, I'm going to have to choose a different location because it's filling up so fast.
Yeah, it's really exciting this year. Demand is really, really strong. And then also actually, so we have a couple of allies that aren't quite under the same kind of umbrella we have over our North American camps, but we're allied with Camp Quest UK in the UK. And then there's a new Camp Quest in Europe actually starting in Switzerland this summer too.
Where is it? Tell me about it. I love Switzerland. It's like one of my favorite places in the world.
Well, I'm not super familiar with Switzerland, but it's in Obersaxen.
The sprawling metropolis of Obersaxen.
Yeah. Well, you know, camps are usually in rural areas. You know, that's where there's land and space and beautiful vistas to have a camp.
Well, the vistas there are frankly the best I've ever seen. And I've been fortunate. I've gotten to travel a fair bit, and Switzerland's the best in terms of natural beauty. I mean, it is just gorgeous mountain, Alps, and forests and rivers and lakes. That's got to be the best camp in the world to go to. Oh my gosh, so cool.
Yeah, it's really exciting.
Cool. Camp Quest Switzerland, awesome. The camp where they make fondue.
Right, totally.
That's sweet. Well, thank you so much for co-hosting today's show. Another reason actually we brought in Amanda is because she knows a little something about rationality. And in a little bit, we'll get to our guest this month, Julia Galef, who is the president of an organization called Center for Applied Rationality. But before we get to that, there's a couple of new exciting things going on. Amanda, you want to talk about any of them?
Sure. One thing that I'm really excited about is the American Humanist Association convention coming up at the end of this month.
And I'm
excited about it because Camp Quest West, our California location, is doing a kids program there for children ages 5 and up. It is going to be really fun. They're going on a field trip to the Children's Museum. They're playing in the swimming pool. They've got science activities. And you can get more information about that at conference.americanhumanist.org/kids. So if you want to bring your kids to the AHA convention, they will have fun things to do. If your kids are too young for the Camp Quest program, there's also child care services for younger children, 4 and under.
That is awesome. That actually sounds like it might be as much fun or even more fun than the conference itself. Can adults hang out with the Camp Questers rather than going to see the speakers?
Well, you know, if they sign up to volunteer ahead of time, they could talk to Camp Quest West, and if they're looking for a couple more volunteers, maybe so.
There you go. How about that? Listeners, if you'd like to go yourself or bring your kids, etc., the conference is May 30th through June 2nd, the end of this month, in San Diego, California. It will be featuring speakers like Dan Savage, Greta Christina, Kathy Pollitt, Carl Kuhn. It is going to be a lot of fun. There's actually going to even be a panel facilitated by Richard Dawkins. So, yeah, please come out to the conference, and you can learn more about it at conference.americanhumanist.org. I look forward to seeing you there. Let's see. There's some other cool stuff in the news, some good news. I love good news in the news.
Yeah, so, me too.
13 down, 38 to go. Was the post on the AHA's Facebook page today, which I, of course, encourage you all to like on Facebook. Plug. but 13 down, 38 to go. So of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, 13 now have marriage equality. As of today, actually, Minnesota will be signing it into law this afternoon. That's 3 states in like a week and a half, which is just fabulous.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I'm so excited to see that issue moving so much, so fast all of a sudden, and to see how the cultural tide has really turned on that. And I was listening to, I don't know, some morning mainstream TV show at the gym the other morning. And, you know, the anchors were talking really positively about marriage equality, and you just wouldn't have seen that a couple years ago.
It's amazing just in the last year, because it was basically this time last year when we lost in North Carolina, my home state, and we ended up with a new amendment that went the wrong way,
yeah,
which was heartbreaking and demoralizing. And then ever since then, it seemed like it's just been a steamroller the other way. It's like that almost was a bit of a tipping point in itself, because it was like a day or two later that Obama came out very forcefully for the first time in favor of equality. And then a number of African-American civil rights leaders came out, and all of a sudden, like, we were like defeated. We hadn't won one of these like constitutional battles. And all of a sudden since then, we're just on a roll, and our side is doing awesome. So it's really cool to see the momentum shift, and gives me a lot of hope.
Absolutely.
So something else I wanted to bring up is a young gentleman by the name of Gage Pulliam. He is a gentleman who is a student in Oklahoma who's done something really brave. And I just want to say a little shout out to Gage to commend him for his bravery and his desire to be a good American and make sure the laws are enforced and that everybody's treated equally, regardless of whether or not it's popular. So, Gage, kudos to you. For our listeners, what he did is he reported his high school, which actually was illegally posting the Ten Commandments on every classroom wall in the whole school and had been for decades. So you get in this situation where it's, oh, it's tradition. We should always do this. This is the right thing to do. Even though the things went up shortly after the Supreme Court ruled it was unconstitutional to put them in the public schools. And so Gage finally decided to do something about it, reported them to the Freedom From Religion Foundation anonymously. People ended up figuring out who he was anyway. So it is now openly known, and he is definitely getting some very nasty looks and is feeling kind of intimidated, but he's doing the right thing. And I think the coolest part about this story, Amanda, is he's talking about some of the support he's gotten. And one of the things he says is like that his principal has said, like, you know, I'll be sure to help you and not let anything bad happen to you. And even some of the football players have like stood up for him and said they'll protect him, which I think is so cool. Like, you know, even in the heart, you know, buckle of the Bible Belt, even a variety of football players, many of whom are very likely Christians and may not agree with the decision of the school district to take down these Ten Commandments in this victory, are standing up and supporting this kid and doing the right thing. So I think that's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, that's really, really exciting. And you know, it's what Gage is doing is so important, because these laws that we have that protect the freedom of conscience and, you know, the ability of all students in their school to feel like they belong and that their school isn't just for some particular religious group or another, but it's for everyone. Those laws don't enforce themselves. You know, it takes brave people like Gage coming out and drawing attention to these issues for these things to get done. And, you know, seeing that his principal is behind him and that fellow students are standing up behind him, you know, that's a real opportunity to teach students what the United States is really about, that it's about the First Amendment and it's about people standing up for what they believe. And so, yeah, a real shout out to Gage and also the students and faculty at his school who are supporting him and teaching their students that lesson.
Exactly. Much love to you, Gage. Thank you for your activism. It's awesome. So, Amanda, I think it's about time to turn the show over to our interview of Julia. Would you like to share with the audience a little bit about who Julia Galef is?
Sure. So Julia Galef is the president and co-founder of the Center for Applied Rationality. She's also a writer, a speaker about issues related to science, rationality, technology, and design. She co-hosts the Rationally Speaking podcast, which is the official podcast of the New York Skeptics. She also is part of one of the awesomest, maybe the awesomest, brother-sister blogging duos out there. She blogs at Measure of Doubt with her brother Jesse, who I have the honor of sharing office space with because Jesse's the communications director for the Secular Student Alliance. And Julia has a degree in statistics from Columbia University.
Julia, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Todd. It's such a pleasure to be on the Humanist Hour.
Yeah.
Did I ever tell you that the Humanist is responsible for my life as it currently is?
No, tell us the story.
I was just realizing walking over here that I never told you this. So about 3.5, maybe 4 years ago now, I'd dropped out of my PhD program. I was a journalist and an editor trying to figure out what to do next. And I had been working at this design and architecture magazine, and I'd been getting kind of frustrated with the interviews that I'd been doing with architects and designers because they kept making these claims about, how their buildings impacted people's psychology or how their like master plans impacted the development of a city. And I would ask, oh, cool, how do you know? And they would sort of look at me funny, like, what do you mean, how do I know? And so I was starting to feel depressed in my current career. And my brother at the time, Jesse Galef, was working at the American Humanist Association. And so I was complaining to him one day on GChat, like, oh man, I wish I could write about something more empirical, more sort of meaningful, maybe something involving science or philosophy or something. And he was like, well, you know, there's this humanist magazine. Maybe you could write a piece for them. Do you have any ideas? And I was like, that's a good thought. I'll start looking around for ideas. And I had some thought that I wanted to write about public's misunderstandings of science and how that leads to sort of false beliefs or false understanding of scientific principles. And I saw that there was this conference happening a week later called the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism. I was like, that looks intriguing. I'll check that out. So I went to this conference thrown by the New York City Skeptics and the New England Skeptic Society. And I was enthralled. I was like, look, this is so cool. This whole community of people interested in talking about evidence and critical thinking and evaluating scientific claims. And so I interviewed all for my, or not all of them. I interviewed a bunch of people there for my article, including Massimo Piliucci, which is the first time I'd ever met him. And we totally hit it off during the interview. And a couple weeks later, he invited me to host a podcast with him. And the rest was history.
That is fantastic.
That's really cool.
Yeah, the article is called Uncertainty in Science. It's a feature, not a bug. And it was in The Humanist several years ago. So that was the beginning of my whole skeptic trajectory.
Awesome.
That is fantastic. And so you've kind of followed that as a career path, actually, and are now actually leading an organization called Center for Applied Rationality. Tell us
right.
And our listeners a little bit about that.
Or CIFAR, if you want to be, you know, cool and colloquial. Right. So the Center for Applied Rationality, we were just officially launched a little less than a year ago. We're a new nonprofit think tank, I guess you could say. We're based out in the Bay Area. We're in Berkeley, California. So the thinking behind CIFAR was this. We know a lot more now. We know a lot more now than we did hundreds of years ago about how we should reason. So just starting at the basics, principles like you should, you know, have evidence for your beliefs, or like your beliefs should change based on relevant evidence. And you know, your confidence should be proportional to the strength of the evidence. Things like that. Your theories should be able to make predictions about the world that at least in principle could be tested. And so we know all this, all these principles about ideally how we should form our beliefs or how we should change our beliefs that have been formalized and known since the Enlightenment, essentially. But knowing them is different from actually internalizing them and using them in our, you know, moment-to-moment reasoning and decision-making. That's much harder. And so far, no one really knows how to get a human brain to actually use these principles of rational thought and decision-making reliably. We do it sometimes, but probably more often we don't do it. We engage in things like motivated reasoning, where if a belief contradicts something we want to believe, then it's much harder for us to accept it, and we'll, you know, find all these reasons why it can't possibly be true. But if a belief confirms, or sorry, if a claim confirms something that we want to be true, then we, you know, accept it unquestioningly. Things like that. We don't automatically look for evidence that might contradict the things that we believe, that might test our theories. We look for evidence that confirms what we already believe. Things like that. So the motivating question behind CIFAR was, can we develop and, you know, test and train people in strategies to make themselves actually use these principles of rationality on a more regular basis, at least when it's important. So starting with the research in cognitive science from the last few decades about how the human brain actually reasons, and the kinds of biases that we're subject to and when they tend to come up, we've been just developing a ton of these reasoning and decision-making habits, sort of like 5-second simple off-the-cuff tools for people to use, and as well as associated triggers, like when you notice you're in this kind of situation or when you notice yourself feeling this certain way, that's a sign that, you know, you might be engaging in motivated reasoning, things like that. So we're testing all these things out on a regular basis and, you know, discarding the things that don't seem to work or like only seem to work for the person who developed it and, you know, iterating and collecting data. We're running a couple of randomized control trials to see what works. And we run these workshops every month or so out in the Bay Area, where we have this like intensive 4-day curriculum where we get 25 awesome people together at a retreat center, and we train them in the best strategies that we've developed so far.
I actually, as you recall, had an absolute blast. I went to the March workshop, and it was really fun. And I'm being really direct here, and this is going to sound like hyperbole, but it is not. I considered it a life-changing experience for the better. I've been a happier, better person that I was beforehand, and it provided me some just phenomenal tools just for day-to-day life. I'm personally just very thankful for it. It was an amazing experience.
I haven't made it out to any of the workshops, but I have been participating in my local Columbus Rationality group.
With my brother.
Similarly, yeah. Similarly, that's been, it's been really helpful to me. I was wondering if you'd tell the listeners and us a little bit more about Harry Potter and the methods of rationality, because that's been a fun way for me to get involved in the rationality community.
With pleasure, Amanda. So Harry Potter and the methods of rationality so I'm going to tell you literally what it is, but that doesn't quite convey the full weight of really what it is. Literally, it's a long-running online piece of Harry Potter fan fiction, which is sort of stories set in the Harry Potter universe, but, you know, with their own sort of creative ideas and plot lines and characters added in. That's sort of literally what it is, and it is one of, I think, either the second or maybe first most popular Harry Potter fan fiction ever. It has tens of thousands of regular readers. But it's also, I would say, the best tool for teaching rationality that I've ever encountered. So it was written by Eliezer Yudkowsky, who is a artificial intelligence computer science researcher whose blog posts inspired some of the techniques that we teach at CIFAR. He's a really passionate rationality communicator. And he wrote this Harry Potter fan fiction to try to get people excited about rationality and to see what it would look like if someone actually lived by the principles of rationality. And so in this case, in this version of the Harry Potter universe, Harry Potter is sort of a rationalist. I mean, not perfect, of course, but he's like a really talented rationalist who goes out and tests his theories and is intellectually curious and, you know, changes his mind when he sees new evidence. And so, for example, rather than just taking the magic, like the collection of spells and, you know, artifacts and potions and everything in the wizarding world for granted, he goes out to do actual scientific testing to figure out by what principles the magic actually works. So he'll be like, well, okay, so I have this theory about how magic ability might be passed down, you know, genealogically speaking. What evidence would I have to look at to test whether my theory is true? What would it predict? Or he'll have this theory about how, what's it called, transmogrification works, and he sets up actual tests that will, you know, test that hypothesis. It's really cool.
It's transfiguration.
Oh my goodness. Oh, don't tell anyone. I got that wrong.
Too late. It's on the record.
Oh no. Well, to be honest, I was so, like, the characterization and dialogue and plotting in Harry Potter and the Methods are actually so sparkling and so compelling, in addition to it just being a good way to teach principles of rationality, that I have to admit, when I read it, I sort of sped through it because I was so intent on finding out what happened next in the story. So I might have missed a few of the little details there, like actually what transfiguration is called.
I had the same experience with it. I read it really quickly. I actually listened to a lot of it on the podcast version. And then switched
devoted
over.
Fans put together a podcast version, which is quite an endeavor because it's like, oh God, 40,000 pages long at this point. That might be an overstatement, but it might not.
Yeah, it's probably not 40,000 pages long, but it's pretty long. There's 80 some chapters, and it's quite an endeavor, but it's really fun. And I want to go back and read it again and read it a little more slowly and kind of let some of the concepts sink in a little bit more, because that's, I think, why it's such a good tool, is that the narrative really pulls you along and keeps you excited and engaged.
Yeah, and actually, so when I did the interviews to select the groups of people who would have at our workshops last year for our May, June, and July workshops, I interviewed probably 150 people who'd like made that second round cut for the admission. And for everyone, there are a few standard questions that I asked them. And one of them was, how did you get interested in learning about rationality? And I kid you not, for probably about a third of the people I talked to, their answer was, well, I came across this fan fiction, a Harry Potter fan fiction called The Methods of Rationality, and it was so cool. And, you know, there were chapters about, like, game theory and about, you know, heuristics and biases and so on, and I just wanted to learn more, so I started researching it. So this has been, like, who would have thought that Harry Potter fan fiction would be the most effective recruiting tool to get people interested in cognitive science and philosophy, but there you go.
We might have to start doing like Star Wars humanism fan fiction just to promote our ideas cross culturally.
Well, I feel like really for humanism we should do Star Trek, right?
Yeah, you're probably right. And in that case, it was already done for us. The original Star Trek was humanist, right?
Yep.
Oh, I have one more Harry Potter and the Methods anecdote that I want to share. So a couple years ago, I wrote a blog post for Three Quarks Daily, just talking about Harry Potter and the Methods and about, you know, how it illustrates good principles of scientific methodology. And just in passing in the post, I mentioned, yeah, and also I, you know, even though I was a fan of the original Harry Potter books, I think that this Harry Potter fan fiction actually has even better plotting and characters and dialogue than the original. Big mistake if you want to avoid a flame war. All of the comments in the comment thread were about how dare you malign the works of J.K. Rowling and how dare you imply that anyone could write better Harry Potter stories than she could. And I tried to remain sort of like, you know, calm and like mostly hands off, but I did say like, well, you know, in the comments I said, well, you should check it out. Like, you know, I suspect you'll really like it. No pressure, but you should check it out before assuming that I'm wrong. And the commenter was like, no, you're just so wrong. You're the wrongest person who has ever said anything. but then, and then I forgot about it. But then a month or so later, I got a ping in my inbox that there was a follow-up comment in the thread that had been, you know, dormant for the last few weeks. So I went to check it out. And the commenter who had been like the most vitriolic in his disagreement with me had returned to say, by the way, I just wanted to let you know, I did end up reading it, and it was so good, you were totally right, and I apologize for being so sure, you know, before reading it.
Wow,
which
and there he's
never
using,
happens
he's
on the internet,
using
right?
Methods of rationality. He's
exactly.
Updating his cached beliefs.
Exactly! I was so proud. It's very satisfying.
That's awesome, because yeah, exactly the people who need to read it are the people who are forming opinions without reading it. Clearly, exactly. Work A that I have read is better than work B that I have not read, obviously.
Yep. I'm the hardest group to reach, right? There's a saying, I forget where it's from, that biases are defined as the study of how other people think. So this is like one of the biggest obstacles to what's sometimes called debiasing, or just, I don't know, like training people in applied rationality, that... Yeah, you know, maybe people will agree that other people make these kinds of mistakes, but, you know, not them personally. So other people should take these classes, just not me.
Right. So we've gotten a little ways into this interview and we actually didn't put out any sort of definition of rationality. So maybe we should do that before we go too much further.
Yeah. So there's different ways I could go about defining rationality. The sort of official definition in cognitive science and sort of related fields like behavioral economics or some fields of philosophy. The official definition actually has two parts. There's epistemic rationality, which is about how you reason and form your beliefs or your conclusions. And the definition there is just reasoning in accordance with the principles of logic and probability theory. So the conclusions that you come to are going to depend on what evidence you have. And so people can quite rationally come to very different conclusions if they, you know, are given different evidence. But it's the process of forming your beliefs can't like contradict logic or probability. So you can't like, hold two beliefs that contradict each other, logically, or you can't, see evidence and argue that that evidence supports your belief, but the reverse evidence would also support your belief. Like that's not allowed. And then there's instrumental rationality, which is about the way that you make decisions about what to do. And so instrumental rationality is defined as making decisions about what to do in a way that maximizes your expected utility, which is sort of a technical way of saying doing things that actually, at least probabilistically, help you towards your goals. And that definition of rationality doesn't say anything about what your goals should be. Like, if your goal is to just relax and have fun, that's a fine goal, but in order to be instrumentally rational by that goal, you should actually be choosing to do things that actually are relaxing and fun instead of things that make you miserable. And so in practice, the reason we have the term applied rationality in our name as opposed to just rationality, well, aside from the fact that it makes a better acronym than CIFR, is that I think that these sort of theoretical definitions of what rationality looks like following probability theory and logic and decision theory, which is where expected utility comes in, those principles are, it's nice to have like a normative model of what sort of an ideal reasoner, ideal decision maker would look like. That's not at all a realistic standard to strive for. Like, even if we tried really, really hard and managed to change all of our thinking, even if we wanted to, we just have limited time and resources. Like, we can't actually spend forever thinking about every single decision. So we have to sort of practice some practical version of rationality and decide when it actually makes sense to think about a decision and make sure that our beliefs don't contradict each other, when it actually makes sense to try to find the best way of achieving our goals. Like, if I'm talking about a goal on the level of going to the kitchen and making a sandwich, probably that's not a very high value decision to spend your time and resources thinking about. Like, maybe there's an optimal way to put peanut butter on the bread, like a way it would taste best to you or something. But you're a busy person. You really don't have the time to spend like testing all your different theories about which, you know, level of peanut butter on the bread is correct or what strokes to use of the knife or whatever. And similarly, you know, if you have contradictory beliefs about something that's not really very important, then so what? It doesn't really matter. So applied rationality then is about not only learning how to train yourself to think more rationally on a regular basis, but about knowing when to do it, when it actually makes a difference.
I'm offended by your assault on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and I'm going to say you're a PB&J heathen.
Hey, you're jumping to conclusions.
You're a PB&J heathen.
Cheesy banana is where it's at.
Oh.
You're jumping to conclusions about what my peanut butter sandwich preferences were.
You can't reason with you rationalists.
I think we may have a heretic on our hands here, Todd.
I agree. So, Julia, we warned you a little bit about that we might go to your brother, Jesse, who works with the Student Alliance, and get some good embarrassing dirt on you. And so
I heard that, and I felt worried for a minute, but then I thought, I've never done anything to be embarrassed about. Why should I be worried? And then I calmed down. So throw it at me. What you got?
So this is from Jesse. You can blame him.
Oh, no. I'm feeling less confident in my unsullied memory.
I'm sure he knows nothing about your youth and stories of college and days before you found rationality. But in any event.
You're just trying to make me nervous. Get to it.
Come on, this is a suspense. This is where they say, like, and we'll tell you who won after this commercial break. So Jesse suggested I ask you, what does rationality say about emotion, and what makes an emotion rational or irrational?
Okay, this is not an embarrassing thing that I did. This is just Jesse trying to get my goat because he knows that this question drives me up a wall. So, okay. All right, fine. So, I have this pet peeve. I call it the straw Vulcan. I did not invent that term. Sadly, I wish I could say that I did. It was invented by TV Tropes, but it describes a phenomenon that has long bothered me in movies and TV, and some books, but mainly movies and TV. So it's this caricature of rationality that Hollywood likes to present, in which being rational means having no emotion at all, or if you do have emotion, squashing it as quickly as you possibly can. So in this model, and it's called the straw Vulcan because a straw man is like a weak caricature of your opponent's position that's like easy to knock down. So the straw Vulcan is a weakened caricature of rationality that's like clearly idiotic and easy to knock down. And it is exemplified best by our favorite Vulcan, Mr. Spock. So in Star Trek, you know, Spock is like quote-unquote the rational one who shuns emotion whenever possible. He also does various other stupid things that aren't actually rational, like assuming that everyone else around him is rational, which, you know, despite having tons of evidence to the contrary, that's like clearly not rational, but it's held up as an example of what rationality looks like, along with not having emotion. And because this version of rationality is like clearly dumb, I mean, not all the time, but in a lot of ways, the day tends to be saved by the emotional intuitive one, like Kirk. And so I have nothing against like emotion and intuition. In fact, I think they're a crucial part of reasoning and making decisions. It always irks me when, let's see, what's a good example of a straw Vulcan in recent months? I remember my favorite. Okay. So did you see the movie Cloud Atlas?
No.
No.
No. All right. Well, you're not missing anything. I'll tell you the parts that bothered me. Towards the end, one of the characters is talking to the daughter of a scientist who she knew, who the character knew, and the daughter says, you know, my father may have been a scientist, but nevertheless, he still believed in love.
As though really, those things are incompatible.
Yeah. I wish that there were, like, some official, like, golden straw Vulcan trophy that you could award to, like, the best example of straw Vulcanism in Hollywood all year or something. Oh, do you have
should
cool
do that.
Too? You could cast, like, a, you know, Vulcan little figurine and, like, award it in an official award ceremony to, you know, the screenwriters of Cloud Atlas.
You should do that, this official CFAR straw Vulcan award.
I might well. Y'all heard it here. It was invented on Humanist Hour. Once it becomes a huge cultural phenomenon.
Absolutely. Once a year, you send out a press release like the Darwin Awards and...
Yeah, the Straw Vulcan Awards. I'm actually like, I'm like 60% sure I'm going to do this now. Straw Vulcan Awards. I just made a note of it so I don't forget.
It would be fantastic. I'd love that.
Yeah, it would be a great way for me to vent my frustrations while actually calling attention to what rationality actually is instead of isn't.
And listeners, Julie actually gave a talk on this at Skepticon a few years back, which is available online. I would highly recommend watching it. It is excellent. So just look up Julie Galef and Straw Vulcan Skepticon. You will find it.
Well, thank you. I should warn people that the audio visual or the audio component of the videos wasn't working for some reason during my talk. So I had all these video clips of Star Trek, like examples of Spock and Kirk talking where Spock was being a Straw Vulcan, and the audio wasn't working. So I had to sort of on the spot, like impromptu, dub in the lines. So
Julia, that was the
want
best
to see
part.
Julia Galef's voice coming out of Spock's mouth or Kirk's mouth. You have that option now.
That was the best part of the whole thing.
Now that we're back on the Star Trek topic and we're talking about Straw Vulcan, it kind of makes me wonder what you think, since we were talking about Star Trek as being humanist earlier, what you think the intersection is between humanism and rationality.
Oh, that's a really good question. So I guess, and just to check and make sure we're using the same definitions of humanism, how would you define humanism?
Well, earlier in the show, I defined it as reason and compassion in action. But I guess another kind of pop definition of humanism is like good without God. So, you know, sort of a progressive life stance that doesn't rely on superstition.
Certainly the latter part of that definition is like, you know, completely in line with the like formal definition of rationality, that a lot of the harms that people do to each other or to themselves come from not actually using rationality. And humanism in the sense of like being in control, taking charge of your own life and your happiness and of doing good rather than, you know, hoping that supernatural forces will do good or help you get what you want. That's all, like, that's what rationality is supposed to help with, right? And then the element of humanism that's about compassion and helping other people and being tolerant and being caring, all of that great stuff. I think that rationality does actually help with that, even though in principle it doesn't have to. So in principle, as I was saying earlier with the definition of instrumental rationality, science doesn't take any position on what your goals should be. Like, it's not technically, according to the definition of rationality, irrational to not care about other people. In theory, you could be perfectly rational if you just cared about yourself and were doing things that's just, you know, optimized for your own goals. In practice, that's actually very rare. In practice, most people do care about other people. At the very least, their friends and family and, you know, members of their community, but also to a large extent, other people who they don't know. We, as human beings, seem to have built in these sort of empathy modules where at least if we can see someone suffering, we tend to identify with them a little bit and want them to not suffer. Obviously, there are exceptions. Tribalism can take over. People's hearts can be hardened other ways. But in practice, it does seem to be the case that we have some built-in empathy for other people and would like there to be more happiness and less suffering. And so rationality in practice can often be used to optimize for those altruistic goals as well. That's actually one of the things I'm personally most interested in. How can we use principles of rational thinking habits, basically, to make ourselves better at helping the world? And I think that a lot of the biases that you'll find in the heuristics and biases literature from, you know, cognitive scientists like Daniel Kahneman or Dan Ariely or Tversky, Fischoff, et cetera, a lot of those biases are actually getting in the way of our society being as compassionate as it could be. What's a good example? Scope and sensitivity. So this is a bias according to which we don't actually care more about a larger number of people suffering because our brains don't process the numbers proportionally. So, for example, if you tell people you can donate $10 to save 20 children from starving, a lot of people would be willing to do that. But if you say you can donate $20, did I say 20 or 10? I don't remember.
You said 10 the first
time.
Whatever, 10,
thank you. If you can donate $10 to save 200 children from starving, people aren't actually much more enthusiastic about doing that. It's like our brain just processes, I can donate money to save some people from starving or some children from starving. And the actual number just sort of, you know, it's like an extra zero. It doesn't actually feel like we're doing any more good, at least when we just think intuitively about it. And so I'm interested, although we haven't really developed any classes on this yet, I'm interested in ways to make the scope of the good you can do or the scope of suffering more tangible so that I care more proportionally with the amount of good that I can do. And actually, some of the most alarming research on the scope and sensitivity bias shows that just showing someone a picture of a single child suffering makes them wants to give more money or makes them more likely to give compared to telling them that they can save 20 suffering children. So like having that one visceral image of a single child is actually more motivating than being able to save 20 children because, you know, 20 is a statistic. One is a tragedy.
Yeah, it's like the old quote attributed to Stalin, right? A single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic.
Yes, exactly.
Stalin, that great rationalist.
I looked up the history of this quote because I wanted to use it in the talk. And it looks like it was originally said by a Polish or Ukrainian, I can't remember, an Eastern European writer named, I think it was Turgenev, who was actually like a subversive social critic. So I don't know if Stalin ever borrowed it from him, but at least the original quote comes from someone less horrifying, which is nice.
That is good.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm curious as to the differences, I guess the comparison and contrasting of the rationalist community and the humanist community, because you've spent some time in both. Like, in what ways are they similar? What ways are they different?
Oh, interesting. Well, they're certainly similar in being intellectually curious and for the most part in being warm and friendly and like fun to be with. They're similar, obviously, in their passion for reason and evidence. I think the rationalist community is maybe more interested in like practical use of the principles. So there's maybe more interest in like self-improvement or in entrepreneurship or using these principles to like do things in the world. There's probably also a little more interest in like complex philosophical problems among the rationalists that I know. Although I don't know, that varies. I know plenty of humanists who are also really interested in philosophy. I definitely think that humanism is a philosophy that's actually positive, not just focused on things that we don't believe, but also on principles that we think should take deeper root in society, like the principles of compassion, and what we can do with those principles. So maybe there are similar focuses actually on putting principles of reason or of humanism to use, but they're just, you know, focused on different principles. The rationalists will focus on like, how do we think better, in order to do more good for ourselves and for the world? And the humanists maybe have less focus on the actual like principles of rationality, but more focus on how do we spread principles of humanism? I don't know if that made any sense.
Or maybe more focused on the goals. You know, the goals being compassion and rationality is focused maybe more on the means. How do we achieve the most compassion?
I think most rationalists I've talked to will sort of take the compassion for granted as like, you know, most people have compassion and want to achieve things in the world and are focused on, yeah, how do we like actually act that way? And how do we, you know, act most effectively to help other people? And then the humanists will focus more on promoting compassion, which is, you know, a super important end in itself.
How do you think our two communities can help each other out and kind of spread our messages more?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, hey, by coming to CIFAR workshops, we offer a lot of scholarships, especially to people who we think are going to do good in the world with rationality. And, you know, humanists seem like the perfect group at the center of that demographic. So if you are interested in using rationality to do more good with humanism, you should totally get in touch or, you know, apply to come to one of our workshops. And we have a lot of scholarship money like set aside particularly for this purpose. So I encourage you to apply. I've been thinking a lot about how to use rationality for more like compassionate, altruistic ends. And I bet that humanists have a lot of thoughts about that as well. And I haven't dialogued with them as much as I would have liked to so far. So maybe I'll try to get more of a conversation going on a blog or something. Maybe the humanist could host a discussion of some sort, written or on the podcast, about using rationality to achieve humanist ends in the world.
That'd be fascinating.
Yeah.
Maybe it could be your next article.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that'd be a nice like blast in the past to write another article for the humanist. I would love to.
Cool. So kind of on that note, I'm curious what your vision is for the future of rationality. You know, if CIFAR is wildly successful and we're, I don't know, 25 years down the road or something, you know, what does the world look like?
Great question. So one of the things that always shows up when I daydream about a future CIFAR is I would love it to be the case that, so right now we're doing this research. As I mentioned, we had this randomized controlled trial that we launched last year where we admitted twice as many people to our June workshop as we had spots for, and we made them all promise to, or like pre-commit essentially to taking a reasoning test and a sort of survey of life, like aspects of their life that they're more happy with or less happy with, measures of success in various dimensions. And then, you know, we flipped a coin and admitted half of them to the workshop and then half of them we told, sorry, come back in a year. And we're following both groups, who are sort of statistically identical, except that one of them came to our workshop and one didn't. And we're following up with them in a year. We're actually just about to collect to do the like 1 year follow-up surveys, to see if rationality interventions, actually make a difference, like a statistically significant difference in reasoning ability or any of the aspects of life success that we care about. But this is like a very preliminary way to do research, right? It's a small sample size. We only had 25 people in the treatment group, 25 in the control. And we're also sort of, it's exploratory. Like we have a lot of things that we're looking at. And because of the way that hypothesis testing works, if one or two of them look significant, that could just be an artifact of the fact that we looked at many things, right? So we do a lot of this like exploratory, quick and dirty research, but I would really like at some point in the near to medium future to start feeding our research back into more formal academic research. So, you know, our quick and dirty research where we follow up with the people who came to our workshops and find out what they're using, what's working for them, what's not working for them, that's not publishable research necessarily, but it is, it does generate valuable hypotheses, promising hypotheses that could then be tested more formally in an academic setting with like a human subjects review board and all of the like standard academic testing protocols in place. So we do have several of the best rationality academics on our board of advisors already, like Paul Slovic, who discovered the scope and sensitivity bias, Brooke Fischoff, Keith Stanovich. And so what I'm hoping is that as our research comes in, we can start feeding it into more formal research and actually add to the academic body of knowledge about improving rationality, because there hasn't really been much research on that so far. It's been a little, but most of the research has been on what biases we have instead of how to improve our biases. So yeah, my vision of CIFAR 25 years in the future includes us significantly contributing to sort of the world's understanding of how to make people more rational through formal academic channels. And then beyond that, I would love it to be the case that companies and organizations, both, you know, in the world of entrepreneurs and also in the world of activism, just send their employees to CIFAR. So like charities or, you know, charitable foundations like the Gates Foundation, just send their employees to CIFAR workshops to learn how to make rational decisions about doing good in the world or about their own lives. Or, you know, if it's not just CIFAR, if there are other organizations that have sprung up teaching rationality as well, it's not just about CIFAR. I care about rationality spreading through any means.
Well, Julia, I'd really like to thank you for being on the show and just wondering if there's anything else you wanted to share before we part.
Yeah, so we have one more workshop coming up. Well, we have one starting this Thursday, so it'll probably be over by the time this comes out. And then we have another one coming up in June, which we have a few slots in left. And I'm sure we'll schedule more soon after that. But if you can't make it out to the Bay Area, we are going to be running a bunch of research programs, essentially, online. I'm putting it together right now, so I can't tell you exactly what the questions are going to be, but essentially we're going to be looking at the effects of different rationality training interventions, and I'm going to be conducting this research all online. So if you're interested in being part of this project of figuring out how to make human brains think better and make better decisions, you can do that from the comfort of your own computer. Just sign up for our mailing list or shoot me an email at julia@rationality.org and mention that you'd be interested in being a subject in one of our rationality tests.
And where can listeners sign up for your newsletter?
Oh, sorry, at rationality.org. That's our website.
Rationality.org.
Isn't it cool that we got that domain name? I was really happy about that.
That's awesome. That's cool. Well, Julia, this is awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Todd and Amanda. It's been a pleasure. I'm sorry I barely let you speak.
That's the goal.
I just get really excited.
Right.
That's the goal. So, awesome. Thanks. Listeners, that was Julia Galef. Again, you can check out her work and her organization at rationality.org. That was a lot of fun. What'd you think, Amanda?
Definitely fun. And I highly recommend everyone check out Harry Potter and the Methods of Rationality.
Yes, yes. I really have found, as I said, learning some of these rationality techniques has really been a game changer for me in many, many ways. So I know my wife likes being around me a lot more since then. I think she liked being around me before, but even more.
One would hope she liked being around you before, but always good to, you know, to improve.
Awesome. So listeners, we have a comment line that you can feel free to call if you have any questions, any ideas. It is 202-618-1371. We'd love to hear from you. Also, you can check out previous episodes of the show as well as show notes at thehumanisthour.org. And finally, please feel free to like us on Facebook. We always appreciate that. We do have one other little piece of news that is kind of cool. We'd like to welcome new listeners. We have WXPI in Williamsport, Pennsylvania that has picked up the show and will be airing it every Friday morning at 10 a.m. So hello, Williamsport. Welcome to the show.
Welcome, WXPI.
Indeed. Amanda, do you have anything else you'd like to talk about?
Well, if you want to register for Camp Quest, it is not too late at a lot of our locations, campquest.org/register. And if you're an adult and you're thinking, why didn't I get to go to this camp when I was a kid? You can go to campquest.org/volunteer and you can apply to be one of our volunteer counselors.
Awesome. And maybe I'll see you there. Is Camp Quest Ohio booked already, or is that still availability?
They still have very few spots for campers, and I think they're full on volunteers, but, you know, you can always fill out that application and, you know, just in case, we might be taking a couple extra people.
Well, if you'd like to trust the most important people in your life to me, you can send them to Camp Quest Ohio. Fortunately, there's a lot of people there that are there to support and knowledgeable. So yeah, it's actually going to be a lot of fun. I'm really excited about it. So cool. Well, Amanda, thank you so much for co-hosting the show and being on. I had a great time and good interview.
Thank you for inviting me. This is really fun.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, thank you very much. Looking forward to next month, where we will be featuring highlights of all of the awesome speakers from the conference, as well as behind the scenes interviews. So check us out in June. Have a good spring.
Or summer, whatever.
Or whatever. Have a good something, listeners. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Watch our brother, watch our children while they kill each other with a gun they bought at Walmart. that love is a good